You may be seated. I'll address the elephant in the room in just a minute. I want to invite you to turn in your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I understand Mike got us all the way through chapter 12, so we're at 13. As you're making your way there, if you don't have your Bible, there is a pew Bible. And if you don't have your Bible, I certainly would recommend you turning to page 175 in the back of the red-orange pew Bible. Actually, this chapter is conveniently located to make a very important point that we're going to make tonight. So page 175 in the red-orange pew Bible if you want to follow along there. It's going to be really tough. I'm going to keep wanting to go to my clicker because I have, you know, I highlight when I'm going to click and I feel like I'll need to do something, but I left it over there, so already I feel naked, as well as being, if you will, a little bit under the weather. I chased my dog Monday afternoon, which is my day off, and it was icy and slick, if you recall. My dog broke her chain. She raced off, and when my dog breaks her chain, she's gone. She's not going to come back, and she won't find her way back. We've had that happen before, so it was imperative that I ran after her. I raced out the door. I barreled through the trees in our backyard, forgetting that my neighbor's yard just is this steep decline, and I rolled down the hill and, you know, obviously hurt something at that point, but didn't think anything of it because I had to keep running to chase the dog. Finally caught the dog, that no good, blah, blah, blah. She did not get a treat. In fact, she'll never get a treat from me again, at least for the next week. I'm going to hold a little bit of a grudge. Considering what we're about to look at, that's absolutely wrong. But she is a dog. And she did do this to me. So I actually exercised that Monday. I went to the Planet Fitness because it didn't hurt that bad on Monday. Yesterday, Tuesday, it started hurting. Tuesday night, last night, I didn't get any sleep. It was in miserable pain, so I woke up first thing and went to the doctor, had it x-rayed. I don't have anything other than a sprain, but man, it hurts like crazy. So the doctor gave me a boot, which is super cool. I don't know if you can see it. It's like, I feel like Gene Simmons. Seriously, if I had another boot, a cod piece, and some demon wings, I could be Gene Simmons up here. But all of that sounds awful wrong in a church building. So just let it be known, I have this boot, and if you see me just kind of squirreling around here, I don't want to sit down unless I have to, because I always feel more comfortable speaking standing up. So I'm going to try to do that. 1 Corinthians 13, we want to get through at least the first half of this, really, perhaps the most well-known chapter in this entire book, for all the wrong reasons. It is a chapter that we will not understand. We won't get at the heart of what it says to us unless we disassociate it from where we hear it the most. Because where we hear it the most is not in church worship, in community, in service, in sharing our gifts, in worship, opening a bulletin, singing songs, praying together. That's not where we hear it the most. Where we hear it the most, if you go to any weddings at all, is you hear it the most when it's surrounded by white dresses and rented tuxes and unity candles. And yet, that's not at all the context for what's going on here. And I actually think that that takes away what Paul's really trying to get at. It's not that it's bad to be used in weddings, but it's not Paul's purpose. It's not why he wrote this chapter. This chapter is here for a specific reason, and you'll notice, and this is why it's so wonderfully positioned in our pew Bible, chapter 12, chapter 13, and chapter 14 are all about spiritual gifts. Their abuses, Paul's need to correct some of their boastful uses of spiritual gifts, some of the ways they're misusing their time together in worship, how they're exalting themselves instead of exalting the Lord. And you heard, if you were here last week, from Mike that they're already abusing things like tongues. There are some that feel that they have these wonderful superior gifts and they don't need the inferior gifts of others around them. Those with less prominent gifts feel like that they're not in any way appreciated. And so there's no love at all as they wrestle with this issue of spiritual gifts. Well, that's the subject of 12 through 14, which means Paul doesn't all of a sudden hit chapter 13 and say, hey, I'm talking about spiritual gifts, but why don't I just wax eloquently on love here for a second? Why don't I just completely detach from what I'm talking about, give some good words about love, and then I'll come back to gifts. That's not at all what he's doing. Instead, everything he has to say here has to do with church life. Not marriage. He's talked about marriage. 1 Corinthians 7, go back and read it. That's his marriage chapter, one we never hear read at weddings. This is his chapter on love within the church community. And that's why, in order to really get at the heart of what he's saying here, we need to put it in its appropriate context. Now, if you were here last week with Mike, you heard him go through chapter 12, another popular chapter. There's abuse of spiritual gifts. People are abusing. Some feel that they don't need others. And if you recall, and Mike certainly probably brought this up, the answer to some feeling inferior and some feeling superior is Paul says, hey, you're one body. And every member of the body matters. Some are more prominent, some are more showy, some are more featured, but every part matters, and especially the parts that aren't prominent, the parts that you don't see, the intestines and the organs and the heart. It's the parts that don't get the prominence that actually keep the whole thing going, so that being a body together means that every gift matters and every person's contribution is important. And because of that, he wants to say, show the same care to all. Make sure that everyone is appreciated appropriately, particularly those that have less prominent gifts. And that's where he ends his discussion that he starts in chapter 12 with a very interesting conclusion. Verse 31 from chapter 12, just so you can see, he's talked about, hey, not everybody has the gift of apostle or teacher, or miracles or gifts or tongues, but verse 31, strive for the greater gifts. And the greater gifts for him are the gifts that develop the common good. For him, tongues is a very personal gift. It edifies the self, but it doesn't edify the body. It's not one of the greater gifts. The greater gift for him, he'll talk about in chapter 14, is prophecy. It is instruction. It is teaching. It is building up the body, helping them to come to a better awareness of their faith and a better sense of what their moral duty is as Christians. So he says, strive for the greater gifts. You need to focus a little bit more on those. But I will show you a still more excellent way. And that's the precursor to chapter 12. I want to show you a higher road, another way. He doesn't want to talk about another gift, because love isn't a gift. He wants to talk about that which is meant to be a part of every one of the gifts. That which is meant to be the outcome of the exercise of every one of the gifts. That the more excellent way is the way of love. It is the high road. It's the manner of life, if you will, the way in which these gifts are to be expressed. And so, having said that, this more excellent way, which we could put in one word as love, he's going to write about love in chapter 13. He's going to say three different main things, and you'll notice the three paragraphs in your reading. The first paragraph is going to be about the primacy of love, how love matters more than anything, and all the gifts are nothing without love, which is a huge statement to say. Then he'll move into the middle paragraph, which is the one you hear mostly read at weddings, and describe the nature of this love. And he's going to say some things that make sense in the context of Corinthians, and I hope to demonstrate that tonight. Then in our next session, we'll conclude it with him saying, you know why love is the more excellent way? It never ends. Prophecy will end. Tongues will end. And in fact, all of our prophecy is mere babbling. It is child speak. It really isn't the fullness. We're still awaiting the fullness. And when the fullness arrives, whatever that looks like in God's consummation of all things, faith and hope will not be necessary, but love will endure forever. Because love's the meaning of it all. Love is what it was all about. So we're going to talk about that, and we'll consider that in our next session together. So that covers kind of the flow of his discourse here on love. And then you'll notice chapter 14, pursue love and strive for the spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy. So he comes back to strive for the greater gifts. I've shown you the more excellent way, and he wants to show how love will be weathered through and expressed through things like prophecy and other things. So we're going to cover the first half of this chapter tonight. I feel like I need to be clicking, but I'm not clicking. If you look at the first paragraph, sometimes this is read at weddings, sometimes it's not. When it is, I'm always kind of at least a little bit surprised, because I'm not sure, again, if some of the language used here connects to your average non-church going person. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, well, what does that matter? If I have prophetic powers, who cares? You know, that these aren't the kind of gifts that necessarily an unchurched person sees as something to be elevated or placed up. But for the Corinthian community, these are. they are holding, some of them, particularly the most boastful that consider themselves the most spiritual, tongues. They're speaking in angelic languages. And then you have those who understand mysteries and prophesy, and then you have others, as he'll move on, that are giving away their possessions. So he's talking about different gifts, and one by one he wants to go through these gifts and show that without love, the gifts end up being useless. They are worthless. So, chapter 13, verse 1, if I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Now, the reason the Corinthians were enamored with tongues is, you know, think how spiritual you seem if you're speaking with a heavenly language. If you're speaking with the tongues of angels, how incredibly impressive that seems, that you have this deep connection to heavenly transcendent realities. It is something you can clearly boast of, or at least, you know, make it so that people are aware that, you know, you're exercising this deeply spiritual gift. Paul says if you do that but you don't have love, you're like a pot lid. You're like a sounding brass. Now, he's not against cymbals, because a finely tuned cymbal is a beautiful instrument. Anyone who likes percussion knows that. But if you have just a sounding brass, or think of a pot lid, and you clang it, it's not finely tuned, it's just making noise. It makes no contribution to the harmony. Instead, it's just this clash, clang, 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 clang. And that's what he's speaking of here. You can have this angelic language, but without love, it's just a bunch of noise. Then he moves on to verse 2, and if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith. Now, if he were to stop right there, you know, I would dig to have all those. Prophetic powers, understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and have all faith so as to remove mountains. You know, that's some high order stuff. That's the language of a deep theologian, someone who has immersed themselves in understanding the shape of faith, the narrative of God, the ways of God. He says, if you have all of this, but do not have love, I am nothing, or I have no value. I've produced nothing of value. All my knowledge has done me absolutely no good, and it's done the church community absolutely no good either, because the knowledge of mysteries and prophecies and faith is supposed to lead to the outcome of love. And to the extent it doesn't, it has failed in its very purpose. So those are high gifts he's placing on the shelf and saying without love they're nothing. Now he gives the highest gift of all, because you can't give any more than this. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body that I may boast, and most assume handing over your body means giving your body as a martyr, giving yourself as a sacrifice. Some translations will say giving your body to be burned, because that's literally what's being said there, that you are giving yourself over in martyrdom, which is the highest sacrifice you can make. You're giving yourself completely. There's nothing left to give. He says, if you make that ultimate sacrifice, verse 4, the end of that, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Which is to say, the gift was total, but the nothingness was total too. Because you can give yourself in a way of trying to establish a reputation, and establish kind of this honor of being a martyr, of showing how committed you were, being focused on the gift you gave instead of how you are giving for the sake of others. It's interesting, and I'll give it just a little parenthesis here. This is why Christianity in its tradition holds two things very highly. One, it is a nonviolent way. Jesus refused to use violence against evil powers. He gave himself over completely. And one of the reasons he gives himself over completely is you can't fight violence with violence. You can't fight evil with evil. This is one of the reasons, that very verse to me, that the whole idea of a suicide bomber is completely misguided. You are performing no act of love when you give your life by tormenting and wrecking the lives of others. In the same way, though, you can do it in what appears to be a noble way. I don't know if any of you have ever seen Murder in the Cathedral. Thomas Becket was a saint in the 1100s, and King Henry II was opposed to him, and they had all kinds of scuffles. And before he was to be put to death, the play that speaks of him, the king says, hey, why don't I martyr you, and then you will be able to enjoy human glory. You'll be able to triumph in the pride of having given yourself ultimately. And Thomas answers with something you've heard before. The last temptation is the greatest treason to do the right deed for the wrong reason. You've heard that before? The last temptation is the greatest treason to do the right deed for the wrong reason. Martyr yourself for human glory. Not for the common good, not out of love of others, but out of love for self and the honor you'll achieve by that. So Paul's listing these gifts, and they're good gifts. None of these are bad, but he is saying that if these don't lead to love, they have not accomplished their purpose. And these are all the gifts the Corinthians were completely enamored with. And essentially he's saying in a backhanded way, you know, you guys aren't accomplishing anything. You're meeting, and you're speaking in tongues, and you're prophesying, and perhaps you're even sacrificially giving. But if you're not growing together in love, and we know throughout the entire book the church is in division. From the beginning, the first chapters, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Peter. They are completely divided. At the Lord's Supper, some are drinking and getting drunk, and others are going without. They are so divided and so dysfunctional. And Paul is here pointing out, you know, you got all the right gifts, but they're not leading to anywhere near the right end. And that's when he moves to this second paragraph where he wants to describe what love should look like. Now, you've heard this so many times, I hope familiarity doesn't breed contempt. I want to read through it just so you can hear it in one nice swoop, but then I want to go one by one through these just in a sentence. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now that's an impressive list, but it's interesting because it really fits into the whole context of this book, particularly in what he said that love is not. But before we consider that, think of what he says love is and what love is not. He starts off with the word macrothymia. Love is patient. Do you know what that word is, literally, macrothymia? Long-suffering. Which is why I always find it wonderful at weddings. The very first, love is long-suffering. Because I guarantee the couple in front of me is not thinking love is long-suffering. They're thinking it's fantastic. It's wonderful. Oh, it's so satisfying. They're not thinking in any way long-suffering. And I guarantee they're not thinking of the end. It endures all things, which is to bear under the weight of the pressures of reality. It endures. So it begins with long-suffering. It ends with endurance. So right away you see that this is not romantic sentimentality in any means or in any way. From the beginning, it's very realistic. And so love is patient. We all know patience is something that can't be rushed. It's something that's opposed to instant gratification. One of the beauties of eros, of romance, and it's a beautiful form of love, is that it does have a certain element of instant gratification. It doesn't take a lot of work at first. It's that wonderful, you know, moving off the runway into the airs of the turbulence of real love. But, you know, going off in the airplane is wonderful at first. And yet this says love is patient. It's not instant. It demands some long suffering. Love is kind, which is to be unselfishly concerned for the well-being of another. It's not envious. And when I think of envy, which is one of the seven deadly sins, I always want to distinguish it from jealousy, because jealousy is if I look at, say, who's the guy who plays Thor?
Chris Hemsworth. Chris Hemsworth.
One of the most beautiful men in all the world, in my opinion. When I look at him, I can be jealous that he has great looks. And there'd probably be an appropriateness in that because he is gorgeous. But envy would be for me to wish that someone would pour acid over his head because I don't want him to have those good looks. Jealousy is I wish I had them. Envy is I don't want even him to have them. I don't want anyone to have any good that I don't possess. That's why it's a deadly sin. It's so self-centered. It is not just a jealousy. It's something far worse. Then he says it's not boastful or arrogant. It's not puffed up. It's not absorbed in itself. It's not rude, which when we think of rudeness, we tend to think of manners, but he's thinking more of things that are shameful. He's not thinking of someone farting. He's thinking of someone doing some dishonorable thing in front of others, even though you could say farting's rude. You see what I'm saying? It's not a manners thing or elbows on the table. It's something more than that. He says it's not self-seeking. It doesn't put the self first. Irritable or resentful has to do irritable just as easily angered. Resentful is when you harbor grudges and you keep a list and someone's on your SHIT list and you keep them there and you brood over it and you allow that to become this deep, deep root of anger and resentment toward them. It rejoices in the truth, which means it hates all kinds of spin and rhetorical coloring and trying to, you know, turn things and make it so that you justify certain things in light of, well, you just had to do this. It rather would see truth. And then he hits the crescendo at the end with, it bears, and what you need to notice is, all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things, which is a way of saying there's no limit. It's willing to believe, bear, and hope, and bear under, or hupomeno, endure all things. So that's a pretty good description. It begins and ends with kind of enduring and toughing it out, long-suffering and endurance, but it has some nice qualities there in the middle. But the thing we often miss, if we don't read it in context, is it is interesting that Paul has not just positively described love. He has said a lot of things that love is not. And I want to share with you why I think he has said love is not envious, not boastful, not puffed up, not rude, not self-seeking. And it's very, once you see this, you'll never unsee it. You're familiar with this book by now. Many of you who've been with me from the beginning of this book, every one of those nots are things the Corinthian church is guilty of. Not envious. Chapter 3, when he talks to those who think that they are spiritual, he says, as long as there is envy and jealousy among you, aren't you of the flesh? So he says they're of the flesh because of their envy toward one another. Not boastful. Well, chapter 12, they're boasting of their gifts. Not puffed up. He said in a number of places, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Not rude. Well, the man that was sleeping with his stepmom is doing something very dishonorable and rude in that society. And they're putting up with it. They're actually, some of them are promoting it and seeing it as a wonderful thing that they're so willing to accept that. And then not self-seeking. If you remember the meat sacrifice to idols controversy where people decided we can eat and if they don't know the right thing to do, that's their problem. And he says, don't seek your own advantage, but that of the other. I'd rather not eat meat at all than do that and seek my own concerns and hurt my brother or sister in the faith. So what's interesting is every one of these knots are things that he's already condemned the Corinthians for doing. Not envious, not boastful, not puffed up, not rude, not self-seeking. So what's amazing and ironic, in a backhanded way, as Paul writes this paean of love, he is also sharply criticizing their behavior. He's saying, everything you guys are doing is what love is not. You are envious, you are boastful, you are proud, you are rude, you are self-seeking. And so he is actually, while praising love, at the same time blaming the Corinthians. And so this is what's interesting. You put into context, rather than being a hymn glorifying how wonderful love is, the words become a subtle commentary on what's rotten in the Corinthian church. Are you following there? That he's actually putting his finger on all the places they are failing miserably and why they are falling short of love. And it all goes back to the opening chapters. They are so filled with rivalry. They are so filled with envy and boasting. And Paul wants to say in these words, if love is what matters the most, you Corinthians have failed miserably. And for all your efforts, it could be, you go back to the first paragraph, you've accomplished nothing significant because you haven't loved. And all that I'm having to address, all these problems that I'm bringing up, that the reason I'm having to bring them up, all comes down to one simple truth. All of your efforts are in vain because you're doing nothing in love. Everything is instead done in ways that oppose love, and it just short circuits everything you're doing. So that's what I think is going on here, and that's why, as beautiful as that paragraph is there in the middle, once you see it in context, you realize that Paul is both praising and blaming. He is both inspiring and yet challenging, which is the genius of Paul, that he's able to say these words and invite them to a higher way, a more excellent way, while at the same time subtly accusing them of having fallen short of almost all of these things. He has hope because he believes that by grace they can change, but he also is going to very much challenge their behavior so that they see that the problem with spiritual gifts, the problem with everything for them, really boils down to the fact that they have to learn how to love one another. How to learn to love one another in this community, to not be divisive, to not be full of envies and rivalries and boasting and rudeness and self-seeking, but to seek the good of the body, to be patient toward others, to endure, to believe, to hope, all of those things. And that's what I see is going on in these first two paragraphs. Now, we want to leave that last paragraph for our next session because it is such a good paragraph. In my opinion, one of the highlights of this book, particularly because of what it'll say about what we can know now and what we can't know, and why that shouldn't bother us that we can't know everything, but that there's something wonderful about being known and being loved. So we'll cover that next week. As always, I have three reflections, and so you have to listen. I can't click what the reflections are, so this is reflection one. Reflection one is rescuing 1 Corinthians 13. One of the things that we as believers in the body of Christ need to be concerned with is rescuing 1 Corinthians 13 from the romantic sentimentality that popular piety has embedded it in. The idea that somehow this passage has become linked to flowers and kisses and dresses and tucks is instead of bulletins and doors and worship and singing and prayer is, I think, I would use stronger words, but I won't. I think it undermines the very purpose of what... It's easy to kind of transfer it, make it sentimental, and all of a sudden we can then have a reason to excuse ourselves from not making it central in our church community. Because it's a sentimental passage about marriage. It's about romantic love. It's not about how I'm supposed to love you guys. It's not about how I'm supposed to patiently endure and believe and hope and all of that with... you, it's you know, just one special person. And so I think that one of the things that we need to do as we reflect on this is realize that one of the reasons we need to rescue it is because it's clearly not sentimental. You look at those qualities, these are powerful actions of love. They don't have to do with just the budding excitement of eros, which is wonderful. They have to do with the long obedience in the same direction of a commitment to a group of people that sometime rub you the wrong way, that you sometime have to endure, that you sometime just have to suffer with, that you sometime have to just simply say, I hope for the best, but man, oh man. I think that that's one of the reasons we have to rescue 1 Corinthians 13. It invites us to a suffering love, which of course, when we talk about suffering love, you can say, well, Rich, that's just you being morbid, but I would just point you to that and say, no, that's being cross-centered. The love of God is a suffering love. It is a love that's willing to endure hardship for the sake of the beloved. It is a love willing to endure, to be patient, to believe and to hope and to go through all that, to go through misunderstandings, to go through disappointments. It's a patient and costly service to others. And of course, that's one of the things we as a church need to be committed to. So, first one is rescuing 1 Corinthians 13. Hopefully we can begin to do that and continue to do that because this is central to all it means to be a church. The second thing is, when you look at that second paragraph, love is more than a feeling. That was the name of this message, by the way. Click, more than a feeling. Boston, 1970-something. We could have called it Bring Me a Higher Love. We could have done that as well. It's always tough because there's so many classic rock song titles I could use. But love, according to that second paragraph, requires the formation of character. These are holy habits, and as proof, just the very first one, patience. you don't get patience instantly. Patience is only developed over the long haul of being hurt and wounded and continuing to love. That's the only way of suffering. It's, I don't like this, I'm uncomfortable, I'm not really, you know, content here, but I will endure. I will be patient. So that these qualities, and patience isn't the only one, all require some kind of holy habits or learned patterns of behavior that must be cultivated over time. And one of the beauties of the church is that these are patterns of behavior that should be learned over time in the context of a community that both models these behaviors and also supports these behaviors, encourages people toward these very things. You'll also notice in that mere second paragraph that every one of these is actions. What's sad about our English language is we can't translate that middle paragraph well because patient is not a noun. Kind is not a noun. These are verbs. Love patiences is, if you want to get literal. Love kindnesses, and none of that, you know, works with us. So if you want a better way to kind of make it more in line with our use of the English language, love waits patiently. Love shows kindness. Every one of these things is an action. It is a verb. And when you read it that way, all of a sudden you realize that love is defined by what it does, not what it says. What it does and what it doesn't do. It does not envy. It does not boast. Instead, it believes all things and hopes all. So that it's a very active quality, and when you realize its action-centeredness, then you realize this really is about developing holy habits, cultivating character, cultivating qualities that allow us to actually demonstrate love no matter what our gifts are, no matter what we have to contribute to a church community, that we are trying to communicate and express these kinds of virtues and qualities and not express other kinds of vices and negative behaviors. So that's the second one, habits of love. Third and final one, and this is so simple, it's going to sound trite, but I don't know any other way to say it. The third one was this. In church, only love matters. When it comes to a life of a church, if Paul has anything to say, you can have tongues, you can have prophecy, you can have self-sacrificial giving. If you have don't have love, none of it matters. It seems to me that as simple as it sounds, and maybe it sounds trite and superficial because we have kind of toned down love to where it is just an erotic attraction, just kind of a gratifying feeling I'm having. Oh, I feel the love. Well, if Paul has anything to say about love, you're feeling the love not only when you got the butterflies, you're feeling the love when your stomach aches from enduring someone, of trying to hang in there. That's also love. And so if it's true that in church only love matters, then love has to be the criterion by which we assess all that we do. We need to constantly ask ourselves, how do our actions and relationships within our congregation express or fail to express love for one another? How can we ensure that our presence, our actions, our contributions don't give more noise, clanging cymbals, but instead produce a sweet aroma of community building, others-oriented love? One theologian writes, love is the mortar between the bricks of the Christian building. It's the glue that holds everything together. It's what all of the gifts are about. And one of the things I find interesting about every one of these aspects of love is none of them are ego-centered. Now, he's very clear when he says it's not self-seeking, but when you're patient, you're not focused only on yourself. When you're kind, you're not focused on yourself. When you're not envious, you're not focused on yourself. Every one of these tries to remove the ego or the self from the center of the equation so that all you're concerned about is what I'm getting out of this, what this does for me. It is always about how does this build up the other? How does this contribute to the common good? So I think in many ways, with some of the things Paul's saying in that second paragraph, he's trying to debunk what is so popular in our days, this self-centered spirituality that it's really about me. And it's about what I get. And it's about whether I find that the worship is effective and useful for me. It's about what I get out of this. It's about what I feel that, you know, is coming my way. Instead of realizing, no, our shared Our shared habit together is to try to, as best we can, focus our attention on the one who is love itself so that we might learn to love as that one loves. And the way that one loves is, I came not to serve myself, but to serve others. I came not seeking my own glory, but the glory of God and the good of others. And so he's going against any kind of self-centered spirituality altogether, and he certainly is doing it when he talks about love being suffering at the beginning and enduring at the end. I've experienced this in my own life. I'm sure we all have. I have the advantage. I get paid to be at church. I've done this 26 years now. I've said this before, so this is a broken record, but I have, in my 26 years of experience in a Christian church, some of the deepest, most profound relationships, some of the people I hold highly and love deeply and think so honorably of are people who are committed to a church, many of them behind the scenes that you just don't see what they're doing. They're just building up the church. They're serving in love. And I've also had, and no one in this room, but I've had the worst hurts experienced in my life come from church leaders, church folk, who want to undermine and not love me. And so I felt that on both sides. And here's the thing, and they only bring that up for this one reason. If I weren't getting paid, I think I would have ditched it long ago. That shows how pathetic I am. And that's why I'm saying this. That's why I hold those of you and those who carry on in the highest esteem, because you do it just because you know you're supposed to do it. Now, if I weren't in this position, I'd hope I'd be just like you in the pews, hanging in there no matter what happens, learning patience, learning endurance, learning to try to give, even though sometimes it's hard to give. And yet the reality is, we all know people who have found it too tough to love, and so they get going. Or they find it too tough to remain patient and endure, so they jump to the next church, which lasts for 5 years, and then they jump to the next, just like kind of serial monogamy. It's just one to another until the romance is gone and you move on to the next one. That's why I think Paul's words are so important, because he's talking about a love that invites us to love long, to love deeply, to love passionately, to love with the deepest commitment, to be willing to endure some knocks and some setbacks, knowing that all of that's part and parcel of what it means to do what is of lasting value. Because love is what matters. Love is what matters. Well, to take one edge away from that last statement I've said, and I'm done, and this is just my conclusion. When you say that in church only love matters, you think, well, that can sound trite or trivial, but it's not surprising that only love matters. When you think that Paul would have prayed in the morning and the evening the Shema, which was the most important life-forming, character-forming prayer of the Jewish tradition, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, so strengthen mine." And then his Savior, Jesus, comes along, and when Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, so strengthen mine. Love your neighbors yourself. On these two hang all the commandments." And then he knows that Jesus, who has said to his disciples, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another, as I've loved you." So it's not surprising that love is what matters the most. And in the end, isn't that good? Because what we celebrate is a God who loves us in the world. God so loved the world, including us, that God gave everything in giving the Son. And that's where you begin to realize, if love is like this, and if this is an echo of the divine love, how wonderful it is to look at that middle paragraph and say, this is how God is to you, inviting you to be the same way to your fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, and then to the world. That verse 4, God is patient with you, long-suffering, willing to put up with a lot. God is kind, not ready to strike you with a thunderbolt, not ready to give you a sprained ankle because you're such a loser. That's not how God works. God is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. God does not insist on God's own way. God is not irritable or resentful, just getting angry at the touch of anything. God does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. Because here's the God we love. God bears all things. God believes all things. God hopes all things. God endures all things. God is willing to go to every extreme to demonstrate the divine love to us, and thus we as the body of Christ are called to go to the same extreme to show love to one another in whatever gifts we have to offer, with all the varieties that they are, with all the beauty of the different flavors and colors of what we have to contribute. Would you pray?